You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Welcome, all you wiretappers out there. We're here in the studio of Gangland Wire. I'm on the Skype with my good friend, mob historian, and co-host today, Camulus Robinson. Cam, welcome.
Hey, Gary, glad to be here as usual.
Yeah, well, don't forget, folks, hit me up on the Venmo app or go to my website and make a little donation. We like to keep Blueberry, the name of the podcast host, paid, and maybe buy a new microphone one of these days. I got the same old microphone I've had for quite a while, and I know Cam just bought a new microphone for his, so we could buy him another microphone, too. So anyhow, we're going to take a look at the Montreal family. Cam's done a bunch of research for me on this. You know, I just got done with that mob film festival and had my my new mob movie, Brothers Against Brothers, the Savella-Spiro War, which you can buy it off my website or you can see it on Amazon Prime. Well, folks, Cam's been really helpful because I've been tied up with this mob film fest and finishing off my movie, Brothers Against Brothers. So we'll get right on with the Rizzuto crime family in Montreal. I've had several inquiries from Canadian fans about doing something about Montreal and that area up there. And I keep seeing people post stuff on Facebook. There's a lot of organized crime going on up there in Montreal. A lot of killing going on the last few years. You know, we haven't had a mob murder in Kansas City since... 1992, 93 or something like that was the last one we had. I don't know how many they've had recently. So, Cam, let's talk about that. Of course, I'm sure they started like most of them coming over at the turn of the century, and a lot of Italians immigrating, had some black hand and moved on into the more modern times. I see you wrote that down here, some guy named Vincenzo Vic Controni, and he was from Calabria.
Yeah, that's what's interesting about Canada and continues even today is the Calabrian Mafia, which is the Ndrangheta, continues to be the defining force, with the exception of when the Rizzutos were in control and they were Sicilians. But the Ndrangheta, and y'all can jump on me for my pronunciation.
Well, that's pretty good. That's better than I can do.
They seem to be the major force up there, Calabrians. And you know, my great great grandfather was Italian. He'd say, you know, Calabrian, and he'd spit on the ground. So there's a lot of infighting between Italians.
Yeah, I was just doing a little research on another story about the Gotti, about the Gambino family. And Gambino, Carlos Gambino, and then Paul Castellano continued this. He had this connection with some people from Sicily, and they were Sicilian mafia guys. They came over. You've heard of the pizza connection and all that. And they came over to the United States and really set up a whole heroin distribution organization. And Castellano got a big piece of that. But when Gotti took over, his family was from Naples. They were Neapolitan. Mm-hmm. And he looked down on the Sicilians. So, you know, it's like the Sicilians, the Calabrians, and what's the other?
Sicilians, Calabrians, and the Napolitanos. Naples. Yeah, Naples.
Naples, that's the Camorra. Well, they all...
Napolitans.
You know, they look down on each other. So, mm-hmm. Interesting. So yeah. Tell the folks a little bit more, and tell me, too, because you can educate me about this Vic Controni and what he had going on.
Controni came over, and he had some heroin coming in, but he was... When Carmine Galante went up to Montreal in the early 50s, he started working with Controni, who was a local crime guy. They started importing heroin from Sicily, and it would come down the St. Lawrence River. That was 90% of North American heroin was funneling through Montreal and then down into New York in the 50s, and it continued. A huge amount of heroin would come through Montreal, but they would get it down the St. Lawrence River, and Controni was in control of things right now. He had a large crew, and I don't know that it was quite up to a family, but as soon as Galante moved in, they set up a street tax, and that really allowed Controni to consolidate his organization and to really take over. So it was Controni, who was Calabrian, and he had his brother involved in it. And he had his capo, who was another Calabrian, but he also had a Sicilian faction that was led by a couple young Sicilians, including a young guy who would go on to be a major factor named Niccolo Rizzuto. So the Sicilian factor of this majority Calabrian Ndrangheta group was Niccolo Rizzuto. And through the 50s, 60s, and 70s, this Cotroni organization worked really steady with the Bananos. We'll say Galante was kicked out in 1956, and then guys like Philip Rastelli and Frank Mari, these guys were back and forth between Canada, and the Lucchese's had a presence up there also. So with the backing of the American Mafia, the Cotroni organization really flourished and consolidated the majority of the territory up in Montreal.
That worked real well because they had the market. They had the consumers in Montreal. There's going to be a few consumers up there in Montreal, mm-hmm. not like there is in the northeast part of the United States. Chicago, and New Jersey, and all around that northeast, huge population center, a lot of consumers there. So it was like a match made in heaven, if you will, for that kind of a thing. Because I understand that these. Montreal families, and it kind of came on through. Rizzuto took it over, but they had these Montreal docks wired. They had control of the docks, and probably through the unions, and there's a lot of corruption up there, and it seemed like in police.
Canadians are so nice, you wouldn't really think about them. But apparently they've got it sewn up.
Up there, you always think of Canada's being squeaky clean.
That's right.
I guess they didn't care.
In the mid-60s, that's when the Bananos start having their problems and their internal wars, and Joe Bonanno does his nonsense, and they have the Banana Wars, and that runs up, and Carmine Galante is imprisoned in 62, and then you've got some problems there. So I think that sort of broke up some of the cooperation. There was still plenty of heroin, and there's going to be plenty of buyers, but I think that 10 years of discord within the Bananos, and then that would be followed up by Donnie Brasco. But so things began to get a little unstable in Montreal. Cotroni was sent to prison in 1974, but throughout this whole time, the Sicilians, led by Rizzuto, were getting a little bit, they were kind of growing in power, and they were not appreciating the leadership. This guy Paolo Violi, who was the underboss, took over after Cotroni went to prison. Rizzuto thought he was a weak leader and started shooting. So this Paolo Violi and his brother Francesco Violi, who was the consigliere, they both end up murdered. Rizzuto start wiping out the entire Cotroni organization, and Rizzuto has more and more Sicilians are coming over. Rizzuto starts making connections in Venezuela with different cocaine organizations. And this guy Paolo Violi was assassinated. He was the boss. Rizzuto was in Venezuela at the time, so he said, "I didn't have anything to do with it. I wasn't even in the country." So he was smart enough to be his main enemy. He was out of the country when he was killed, and after the death of Violi, the entire Cotroni organization basically became dormant for the most part, and the Rizzutos took over under Patriarch Niccolo Rizzuto.
Interesting. That's kind of where the bad blood series started with Rizzutos.
That's where you see Vito Rizzuto really sort of make the rise, because the Bananos had just had their... It was right before the Donnie Brasco incident, and this is where a lot of your listeners and what you were touched on, this was when Vito Rizzuto, as part of solidifying those ties with the Bananos, came down to New York and took part in the infamous Three Capos murder.
That's a really interesting story. We'll do a second episode and really examine that one deeply, because that's a really interesting story, and that's a pretty good picture. There's a picture, I've seen it out there, with how they made Vito Rizzuto down here the day of the hit. The FBI had a surveillance photo of him with Joe Mussino and some other people.
Are Canadians in that picture, except for Joe Mussino.
Yeah, except Mussino, yeah. So, interesting.
So you've got, now they've solidified their ties with the Bonanos, and Bonanos weren't the only ones involved in that. They tied in the Gambinos. So now there's a direct connection with the Rizzutos to the mafia in New York. You've got the Contrera Coruna mafia clan of Sicily, who were part of that pizza connection. They were supplying the heroin to North America, and they figured, we'll just go ahead and take over the Canadian market too. And because they were dealing directly with Sicilians, that really cemented the bonds there. So you've got direct Sicilian pipeline to that heroin that was being processed in Sardinia, I think, and coming in through France. And then you've got the Cali cartel, which the Rizzutos made contacts with in Venezuela. And the Cali cartel were much more business-oriented, for those of you who have seen the Narcos. The Medellin cartel was coming up through Florida. The Cali cartel had most of California, but they also had these direct, they were expanding. The Cali cartel had ties to Europe, and they also had these Rizzutos up in Canada. So the Rizzutos really diversified as far as their drug organizations and their ties to North America through Vito Rizzuto and Nicolo Rizzuto's contacts. They were really, really smart how they went about taking over and expanding their operations. A lot of people consider the Rizzutos as just an offshoot of the Bonanos, and I think that's really not a fair way to look at them as a Bonanno crew. I think they were really an international organization unto themselves.
Really could have, in a way, cut New York out, because they got their own Sicilian connection coming directly into Montreal. But they maintain the relationship because they really needed the market down there. They had to have that market. But they weren't that big of a family. I got a feeling they may be a little bit like Chicago and Kansas City. I would draw that parallel. I'm not convinced of that. But like Kansas City, we totally operate on our own here. Yeah. But if it affects something that affects anything outside of Kansas City, and especially if Chicago has any piece of the action, like the skimming from Las Vegas casinos, they run it by Chicago. I've heard some wiretaps where Nick Savella is talking about wanting to calm Lefty Rosenthal down out there because he was creating so much stir with the gaming control board. And he's has this conversation with his underboss, Tuffy Delaney. He said, well, do you think... And he used a code name, 22, but he meant Iupa. He said, do you think Iupa would mind if I talked directly to him? And Tuffy said, well, he said, you know, we had that conversation. They'd had a meeting a year or two before that when this got started, kind of outlining who was supposed to do what. And he said, we had that conversation. I don't see any problem why you couldn't call him directly. And so he ended up calling him directly, although he did call through his lawyer, Oscar Goodman, first, and kind of like let Oscar Goodman know that he was calling him up and wanting to straighten him out and calm him down. So it's interesting how mob protocol and how that works.
Yeah, and it just across the board how they all sort of recognize it, and as long as it's serves their interests.
Yeah, when you're making money together, you want to make sure that everybody knows what you're doing.
That's right.
You don't want to do something without them knowing what you're doing. And if you got one bigger family that has all the markets particularly, but it's a much bigger family, then you better know where your place is, I would say. And Rizzuto was smart. He was a smart dude. He knew where his place was. They weren't asking very much out of him. Just keep the heroin going. They'd keep the money flowing back.
That's right. You got Niccolo, the patriarch. The old man goes to prison in 1988. He was arrested in Venezuela and actually did his time down there, I believe, but that's 5 years. And during this time is where Vito really comes into his own. And you see this sort of discussed in the background of Bad Blood, where they talk about all the smart business moves that Vito did. Yeah. That's where he involves the Hells Angels. They've got the muscle and they've got the methamphetamine, and also for the narcotics distribution in Canada. So they've got, you know, the importation, manufacture, and distribution of drugs there. They've got control over these smaller Ndrangheta families in Hamilton, Ontario, seems to be where they all consolidated. There were three competing families down there from Calabria, the Musitanos, Lupinos, and the Papalia family. And there's been a lot going on in Hamilton, Ontario recently. That could be a show unto itself. This is mob war going on in Hamilton. But they also had the street gangs who paid protection to the Rizzutos for political connections, and they distributed drugs and access to, you know, they had to pay the Rizzutos if they wanted to sell drugs, because they had to get the product. So the Rizzutos basically owned the police, they owned the politics, and they could protect all these underground organizations, but they weren't selling the drugs themselves, and they wanted a little bit of street muscle. So Hell's Angels, Ndrangheta families, and regular street gangs, the Rizzutos basically had all organized crime in at all levels in Montreal, and I would imagine a good portion of Canada sewn up.
Yeah, really, it's amazing. I've never seen that in Kansas City, where our crime family never ever had anything to do that I knew of with street gangs, or with motorcycle gangs. The one we don't have Hell's Angels here. We had a pretty good size Galloping Goose organization that was doing some narcotics distribution, but. Well, they didn't have anything to do with any of those guys like that. There's a few like street criminals that were really good street criminals, you know, good thieves that they would use and get a piece of their action there, you know, and fence their property or whatever, and maybe use them for something. But boy, from an organizational standpoint, and that's a hard one. They must have those Hell's Angels up there, and they must have had pretty good control over their guys to then, you know, to throw in with the Italians like that.
When you control the police and the politicians, and you control every bit of every way to get somebody arrested and put away, and you control the entire drug trade, I guess it's more of a business decision than anything else.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You know. And so the Rizzutos are running all of Canada until 2003. So, and that's we can get into Hamilton another time, but they had such control. So the Rizzutos in 2003 is when Joey Massino, he was the first head of a mob boss, active head, who rolled over. He became a government witness. And as part of that, we know that Vito Rizzuto got a call from the Bonanos that said, Joe Massino is talking to the cops now. He's an informant. And within a day or two, Vito Rizzuto immediately flew down to Cuba and stayed there for 6 weeks, because he knew that if Joe Massino was talking, then there's the guy, then he would be implicated in that Three Capos murder.
Yeah, because it was huge. Law enforcement wanted to know who did that. And Joe Massino, or Massino, could, it is Massino, isn't it?
Massino. Yeah, I've seen Massino, but it's Massino, yeah.
Massino. That's all right.
Get me second guessing myself on these vowels.
Yeah, oh yeah. We all been there. But that was huge, and that would be one of the primary questions, and him being the boss up there would have to know about that.
There was a Canadian comedian, I don't have his name on hand, but the Royal Canadian Mounted Police contacted this guy and they said, hey, you know, you're staying at the same resort. Could you keep tabs on Rizzuto and his wife while you're down there? And so this comedian who had gotten friendly with Rizzuto was funneling information back and forth with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the Mounties, so that they could keep an eye and know what Rizzuto was up to. And then he came back in, let's say, January 20th is when he was arrested because the Americans wanted him arrested, but the Canadians would not extradite if he was facing a murder charge, because that could be the death. So Canadians
many countries are like that. I've heard that before. If they don't have the death penalty, and the government as a philosophy are against the death penalty, they won't allow somebody to be extradited to that has a death penalty. So that's not that unusual that they wouldn't do that. He came back from Cuba all on his own, didn't he? Extradite him back. I think he decided.
I'm pretty sure he came back on his own.
Give himself up. He didn't want to stay in Cuba the rest of his life.
No.
I guess you just sometimes you got to take your lumps. Even when it is on a murder.
He fought it. He got a conspiracy to face murder charge, and he fought it for years. He was arrested in January 20th of 04, and he wasn't extradited until August 17th of 06. So he fought the hell out of it. And right before he left, he told officers, "You will rue the day I leave Canada, and you will see what happens."
Yeah, I've seen bad blood. I know what happens when he leaves.
Yeah, right?
He's sitting down there in an American penitentiary, and things kind of whirl out of control, didn't they?
Yeah, so you've got Vito Rizzuto in 06 going away, and then you've got this gang war starts up, and you've got Rizzuto organization, they start picking it off, but you've got a couple law enforcement actions that start taking place around the same time. This Project Colise, the Canadian law enforcement action with hidden cameras and microphones are planted all over. They got thousands of hours of footage on the Rizzuto organization. And then you've got this high-ranking Rizzuto drug trafficker. He was gunned down in his vehicle in a Rizzuto restaurant. This Federico DiPescio. Nick Rizzuto, who's the son of Vic Rizzuto, was killed in December of 09. He was trying to take over, but he wasn't. He was just... A lot of these mob kids are spoiled rich kids, and as you know, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with it, but they think they're going to step in and take over the throne, and they're just not built for that. They don't have the street smarts. They're not hard enough.
Yeah, just ask John Gotti Jr. He bailed out pretty quick too. In Kansas City, we had four young guys in the Savellas that none of them, they just couldn't do it. You know, there was no way they could do it. They couldn't. They didn't have the guts to, and wouldn't take the risk and do what needed to be done. So they never moved up. And you know, they depicted that in the Bad Blood. I know. I remember that.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. So you got Rizzuto, the son of Vito. You got Vito's brother-in-law, Paolo Renda, who was killed a few months later. This Agostino Contrera, who was a Sicilian partner, part of the heroin connection, he was gunned down in front of his own business. And then the old man, Nicola Rizzuto, was killed in October of 2010. So you've got, in a little over a year, you've got five major leaders of this Rizzuto family, including three relatives of Vito Rizzuto, who were murdered straight out. And then you've got this Project Colise, where they all these hidden cameras and microphones taking them down. And then you've got in 2012, what's called the Charbonneau Commission. It was a massive anti-corruption investigation through all of Quebec. So basically the Rizzuto organization was crippled by, they went after corruption. They went after the law enforcement went after them. They killed the top, they killed the top echelon of leaders, as the whole organization was chipped away at.
I noticed you had this one named Renard Desjardins. They say that was probably the Declan character, although, you know, it wasn't quite the same. But he was, I guess, French extraction, I would say, judging from his name. And he kind of tried to keep things going for a while, but I don't think he lasted either.
No. He and this Montagna, they both... They sort of tried to step into the vacuum, but it was just the Ndrangheta was moving in, and they were really, really starting to step up their presence. They had always had a stronger presence in Canada, and you see that now. There was a recent Ndrangheta bust where they got $30 million worth of homes and a bunch of Ferraris and Lamborghinis, and this was just in the last couple months.
Yeah.
They even today, they're damned powerful, but... So little by little, from 2006 to 2012, between this gang war and these law enforcement and taking out corruption, Vito Rizzuto, when he got out in 2012, his organization had collapsed. It was done. And when he got out, he got as many people together and he said, "Listen, the only thing I give a shit about is killing everybody. I will take 0% of your operations. You can keep all your money. I will pay whatever it takes. I want everybody who went against my family dead."
Wow. Yeah, I see you got some names here. A bunch of bunch of professional criminals started dropping off right after that.
Yeah, within a month of his release, you got four big guys who were all executed. Two more just blown away. I mean, and these aren't guys who were shot in cars or whatever. These are out in public. These are just public executions shot out in the street. It was really a big thing. One guy was this associate of Desjardins, Gaetan Gosselin. He was in his home, and a sniper bullet just came through, and that seemed to be a big thing because that's how Niccolò Rizzuto, that was a sniper bullet. But really, it was just a scorched earth policy when Vito got out. I mean, just gunning people down in the street, and they didn't give a damn. So
That sniper thing, that's really unusual.
Mm-hmm.
That is really, really unusual. There's a lot of room for error when you're going to try to shoot somebody from a distance.
You
know, the normal would be to get them isolated in a place where nobody else could see and put through the head. But they did pull out all stops on this. Plus, they couldn't get next to people because they knew he was out there and they were everybody was at risk, so they weren't going to let anybody trick them into a safe place and get knocked off like Jimmy Hoffa did. He let them trick him into going someplace where there was no witnesses and there was no chances that he could get away.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, Vito Rizzuto, a lot of people still came to him. There was a Canadian billionaire, Michael DeGroote, who was having some problems in casinos down in Dominican Republic with these two underworld-related brothers. I don't think they're the Carboni brothers. And Vito just showed up in Dominican Republic, and these brothers end up leaving him alone. So he still had some pull, but he was sick. He wasn't well getting out in 2012. And then in December 23rd, 2 days before Christmas 2013, he died of pneumonia. And really, Canadian organized crime has just... If you get the updates, if you get the things in your Google Mail, you know, based on your Google searches, you get the updates about organized crime. I do anyway. And you're always getting something from Canada about this shooting or this bust or that bust. I mean, Canada, I guess they're not as, at least their organized crime guys are not as polite as ours. I can tell you that because they're constantly killing each other and getting arrested. Canada's got it locked down.
They do. I think part of the reason is they got so involved with the narcotics business.
Yeah.
And that's such
so much
a dirty
money.
Business where our guys, they never really got, for the most part, in most cities, they got involved with narcotics a little bit in New York, but it wasn't the big thing.
It wasn't their only source. Yeah.
It wasn't their only source. It sounds like the narcotics was such a big deal. And that's always, you know, you always got so many people that are out of control and it's just, it's bad business. And there's a lot of murder that always happens around the narcotic business, whether it be on a street level or all the way up to the top. It's amazing. I remember one time, nobody trusts anybody in the narcotics business. There's absolutely no set of rules and no honor whatsoever with the mafia. And even in Drangheta, I could really butcher that one up, the Calabrians and the Camorra, they have rules. And they understand that you need to follow these rules in order to make money and have a pecking order and a disciplinary process, but just killing people indiscriminately, you know, you don't make any money that way and you draw so much more heat. That's why there's not been a mob murder in Kansas City since 1990-some, because it just draws, they knew it draws too much heat. You don't see many mob murders throughout the United States. New York City doesn't have many. Chicago, when's the last mob murder you had in Chicago, huh?
Yeah, it's been a long damn time, yeah.
Yeah, that was, you know, we did some of those Chicago stories. Bodies were dropping like flies there back in the 70s and 80s. And for no real reason that you could see other than they weren't paying their street tax or something like that.
Yeah, it's just, that's right.
But they don't do that anymore. I guess if you don't pay your street tax now, you know, they realize it's not worth the heat. You figure out another way.
And you know, most of the guys just move on into legitimate business. I know a lot of guys want to say, well, the mob is still. But, I mean, in a lot of places, they were the mob until they got into enough money to put into legitimate business. Guys like Joey Lombardo's family are all millionaires living off real estate. Yeah. So, you know, a lot of these guys tended to invest, the upper echelon guys, and they might have the titles and still, but they're millionaires in legitimate business. So, you know, they're not going after too much gambling anymore.
or yeah, there's no gambling, but go into internet fraud, like I was telling you about in that one case in New York City, and cramming phone bills, and there's all kinds of ways to make money that you don't really have to kill anybody, and it's not dirty, it's clean, and
that's right.
And the sentences aren't so bad. I understand it was smart business staying out of that narcotics. There is a lot of money, but the sentences are draconian, and you know you can get somebody to rat out their mother when they're looking at 50, 60 years in the penitentiary.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's I don't know, it's kind of crazy up there. It's more like the Wild West, and I've read those things, and I don't know exactly what's going on today, but there's continually mob violence in Montreal and Ontario today. Doesn't really happen out west, but boy, back east and northeast it does.
Yeah, yeah, and I know that Hamilton we mentioned, there's been a lot going on right now about these Musitanos and the Lupinos and that Papalia family. They're really in for such a relatively small place, Hamilton. There's for having three large organized crime groups. They're really, really going at it with lots of kidnappings and murders and different things going on up there, and lots of drugs. So in the wake of a group collapsing, we see this in organizations all over. Whenever you have somebody who is keeping the peace or somebody who was an overseer, you see that vacuum of power, and things really go, really do collapse. I mean, in as organized as crime can be, when you see a major factor disappear, there's a huge vacuum of power, and there's always chaos that follows.
Yeah, and usually if a mafia group will have kind of a table of organization, will have a succession plan, if you will. You'll have a boss and a consigliere and an underboss and some capos, and there's a way to orderly transition power so it doesn't just descend into chaos. There may be a little bit as people jockey.
Yeah.
New one, if an old man, if an old boss dies, or if a boss gets killed for some reason, he gets, throws a shoe, or like Joe Bonanno did, or something like that, or, John Gotti killed Paul Castellano, but there was a pretty orderly transfer of power in all those situations, but they don't seem to have that up there in Canada.
No.
Interesting. Okay, well, let's wind this down now, Cam, and then let's do a second episode, and let's examine that murder of the three capos at Vito Rizzuto that really caused this, that Vito Rizzuto got caught up in, because had he not left Canada, I got a feeling that a lot of this wouldn't happen. He'd been able to keep it under control.
Yeah.
You never know.
I think you're right.
Okay. So if you have a friend or relative has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. Don't forget, hit your Venmo app and buy me a cup of coffee or a shot and a beer. I got my new movie out, Brothers Against Brothers. The Savella Spiro War, it's on Amazon Prime, or you can rent it for $1.99, or you can buy it with the special features off my website. You get the DVD. I got my old movie. I think I forgot to mention that in the last couple of podcasts I did. That's getting old hat now, Camp Gangland Wire. Got it out there. And, of course, if you give me a donation, $25 or more, you'll get either Brothers Against Brothers, Gangland Wire, or I'll send you a gift certificate for a Kindle version of my book, Leaving Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. And I have the Kansas City Mob Tour app. All that serves to keep this podcast going. If you notice, we don't have any advertisers, any paid advertisers. And I'm going to try to stay away from that as long as I can. I kind of don't like that. When I noticed two things, Cam, as I've done this over the years. I used to have a really long lead-in. And I didn't really like it, but I kept it up. And then I changed that, and now I have a really short lead-in. Because when I listen to a podcast, I like a really short lead-in. I don't want too much music, and I want to get right to the information.
Get right to it.
And ads, they delay you getting right to the information. Now, I'm not saying I won't put up an ad if we find some really lucrative deal, but until that comes along, I'll resist ads. I did one once just to see how it would work, and they only paid me $15 an episode, and that's not worth it.
That's right.
It's just not to distract anybody, although I did kind of have fun. I talked about a what was it? It was a high-end oil and air filters, canned in filters. So I use my motorcycle as an example about using these high-performance filters and products like this. And so I'd come in and report to my co-host at the time, Aaron, how I'd gotten it up to 120, 125, 130.
I remember that.
135. So we kind of had fun with it. I hope people enjoyed the little commercial they did. I don't know if they sold any oil filters they didn't renew, but I wasn't going to renew anyhow at $15 a crack. And I'd had my fun with it. So, you know, if you can't have fun with what you're doing, don't do it, I say. Would you agree with that, Cam?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Let's say goodnight, Cam. I'll talk to you on this next episode about the murder of the three Capos.
Night, y'all. Thanks,
night.
Gary.
Night, everybody.
Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.